This talk was given by Danica Shoan Ankeley at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Hello. Hello. Looking up from my little mat to see everybody here. You know how, like, when seekers of the way might, like, go off on some kind of pilgrimage or something and then return to, like, the monastery, the main house, and, like, bring back a little bit of what they discovered? That's what this talk is going to be. And yesterday when Yunnan used the word archipelago, referring to Solzhenitsyn's Gulag archipelago, I thought, oh, archipelago, right. That's like all the little islands that are close together, so they kind of function as one body in some way, but they're little islands. And I thought, like, this is our Zendo archipelago, and we each have our little island. And I'm going to bring you back some teachings from Garuda Island. So among the many profound and wonderful blessings of my life here, of which I count among them being here with you this week, I have the good fortune to be the one who gets to assist Hojin Sensei on the Women's Wilderness Trip each time that we've done it so far for 4 years. And 2 weeks ago, went to Lake Lila in the Adirondacks. And some of you know our usual configuration is that we have a couple of paddling instructors and, you know, kind of experts with us to hold part of the trip. And it's nice, I'm looking around and I'm seeing graduates of previous women wilderness trips. So, you know, each one is totally different and each one has its own special magic. And this trip, we didn't have the paddling instructors. And we decided to go anyway after a process, as I'm sure you can imagine. And the door that opened was that we did a lot less traveling around the lake, a lot less sort of adventuring in an external way, and a lot more adventuring in an internal way. And Hojin Sensei brought this text called The Flight of the Garuda, from which the island that we stayed on takes its name, Garuda Island. And this is a text that was written in the 19th century, so relatively recently, by a Tibet Lama, Lama Shakbar, who was an enlightened yogin and considered a reincarnation of Milarepa. And like Milarepa, who's known for his spontaneously composed spiritual songs, Shakbar also taught via spiritual songs or dohas. And so The Flight of the Garuda is a collection of 23 songs on the nature of mind and pointing out the nature of mind and encouraging us to see for ourselves directly what that nature is so that we may be free from suffering. And this was the first time that anyone has actually presented to me a so-called spiritual song sung. And it was kind of amazing. So what happened is over the course of our journey, starting slowly and then picking up some momentum, our little group of traveling pilgrims sang to each other all 23 songs in the collection. And we were totally improvising, so there's no music, right? You're just kind of improvising. A lot we did kind of plain song style, and then that veered. Some people had kind of a country twang take on it. There was one that was distinctly Fiddler on the Roof. And then Hojin Sensei's inimitable rap of one of them. And the Garuda is a mythic bird, or being, I should say, a mythic being, mythic in quotations, meaning just that, that has the head like of an eagle or of a, you know, kind of fearsome bird of prey, and wings, and also the body, parts of the body of a person. And they are said to hatch fully grown. So the moment that the Garuda hatches, it can just like take flight. And so the symbol is that the Garuda is like our true nature, which is already perfect and complete, doesn't need to be developed. It's there. And when we hatch, it's complete, full. So I wanted to take up some fragments of these songs and look at them, and look at them particularly from the perspective of, if we don't feel like that manifest Garuda, you know, if we're not yet feeling that we are a perfect and complete Buddha, to the degree that that feels distant, or that we feel far off from that, how can we kind of loosen up, relax into, kind of come out of our slumber, shake off the dullness, close the gap, awaken from our complacency or our confusion or our discouragement, our irritation, our sticky bad mood, or any feeling state that moves from being an alive embodiment into kind of being a burden or a habit. So, this is from the beginning. I'm just going to offer a few words from the beginning of the first song. The original face of the mind, unborn and primally pure, how wonderful its authenticity and natural perfection. Intrinsic knowledge itself, our naturally liberated nature. How marvelous it is that no matter what occurs, it is released by letting it be. How marvelous it is that no matter what occurs, it is released by letting it be. How marvelous it is that no matter what occurs, it is released by letting it be. So, this teaching, no matter what occurs, how marvelous it is that no matter what occurs, it is released by letting it be. In the Ongo intensive that we had in the spring, Shugen Roshi said, I was looking over my notes, and he said something along the lines of, you know, the fire is extinguished, meaning the fire of samsara, the burning of our torment, is extinguished not by blowing it out, but by shifting the conditions that keep the fire burning. Then later he said, you know, things don't just go away. That's magical thinking. So we have to change. Our condition needs to shift. And we need to change our relationship to our life in a moment. Where else would it change? So that's what we're practicing. This letting it be might sound like I'm not supposed to do anything. Letting it be like not like being active. And in a way that's true, but like we have to see really deeply into just how profound a teaching that is, which means that we have to see into all that we're doing. We have to see into the constant creation. And, you know, when we sit down in Zazen and turn the light around, that's what we've got a front row seat to. Whether we realize it in the beginning or not, we're looking at how we're making our experience. So we're learning how to stop. We're learning how to, like, just let deeper and deeper and deeper, not be so, you know, messing with everything. I mean, and then to learn how to mess with things skillfully, that's the other piece. So we're not just like, you know, frozen or untouched, unmoved, but we're empowered in like the deepest, most real way. So to shift the conditions so that we can change, or so that we can see clearly, we need to start to see that the schisms of the world and the upheaval of the world are the schisms of our mind and the upheaval of our mind. And we learn how to be intimate with this. We learn how to like let the schisms and the upheaval of our mind settle, how to unify our awareness so that we're not turning away from our experience and we're not keeping it churning. And the crazy thing is like you don't have to go anywhere to do this. That's why it like works so well to have a little island. It's like you get on your little island. You don't need anything, no special tools. You're already completely equipped and prepared. You don't have to like go out looking for like challenging situations. They'll show up. And you don't have to go out looking for the resolution to that trouble either. So how do we practice according to that? How do we release things by letting them be? Each person has to like find out what those words are trying to describe for themselves. But you know, it's helpful to hear different attempts to describe it so that we can see, like, you know, kind of continue to find our way. And toward the later part of the flight of the Garuda, there was a song that we had this incredible day, the last day, where, you know, I think when we began, Hojin didn't know, like, how it would take. She was just sort of throwing something out there and seeing, like, how are people going to respond to this thing? And then people were really into it. And she, at one point, was like, you know, there are 18 songs in the whole thing. And we're like, oh, we're going to do all 18. We're going to do all 18 before we leave. And then as we just had a day or two left, and Hojin was like, you know, actually, I miscounted. There are 23 songs. And we were like, okay, we're going to do all 23. Which meant that the last day we were doing a lot of songs, which was kind of incredible. And toward the end of that last day, After a delicious supper out on the rocks of Garuda Island, which I discovered really felt like being on the back of a Garuda because it has all of these amazing rocks that go out into the water like a neck or a tail. We had a song that really like struck me, and I was like, "Ooh, that one's kind of catchy." When I came back, I sang it to Gokhan. I'm like, "Listen to this." So he got a preview. So this is the Unshakable Bolts. All right. First, before I begin, let me just say that I have never heard this phrase, unshakable bolt, before, but I really love it. And I was thinking about it, like, what does that mean? And you know, the Vajra, the lightning bolt symbol is very prevalent in the Tibetan tradition. So I'm like, oh, it must be like the bolt, the bolt of lightning. And as a symbol of wisdom, like, I guess, like penetrating wisdom that just like whoosh, cuts through. And then unshakable, you know, we use that word in Zen to be, you know, as unshakable as a mountain, that kind of steadiness. Because, of course, the schism-making mind is so shakable. It's like you say one thing and it's like, boom, off there. And you say another thing and phew, it's there. And it doesn't know where to go. So it's like, no, unshakable, the diamond, you know, cutting through, steady, the unshakable bolt. It's like double power. And then the other phrase that occurs in here is unchangeable. And unchangeable, I feel like, is another way of kind of saying unshakable. Like, what can we actually rely upon? So if you're a practitioner of the way, and you want to know, like, how do I realize myself? And, like, what should I do? And, like, what can I actually rely upon? This is the instruction for you. Here is instruction on the four unshakable bolts. The unshakable bolt of unchangeable vision is vivid perception of the here and now, and it is called an unshakable bolt because of its permanence throughout past, present, and future. The unshakable bolt of unchangeable meditation is vivid perception of the here and now, and it is called an unshakable bolt because of its permanence throughout past, present, and future. The unshakable bolt of unchangeable conduct is vivid perception of the here and now, and it is called an unshakable bolt because of its permanence throughout past, present, and future. The unshakable bolt of the unchangeable goal is vivid perception of the here and now, and it is called an unshakable bolt because of its permanence throughout past, present, and future. Kind of brings it back. So, the four unshakable bolts are the unshakable bolt of vision, the unshakable bolt of meditation, the unshakable bolt of conduct, and the unshakable bolt of the goal. And so I would say, you know, maybe instead of goal, realization. And they all, perhaps you recognize the refrain, point to vivid perception of the here and now. If you want to wake up and practice in accord with the true Dharma, it is about vivid perception of the here and now. We hear this all the time, of course, so it's up to us to like investigate and see, like, what does that mean? you know, vivid perception of the here and now. We could understand this to be, this is what we're practicing in Zazen, and this goes ever and ever and ever deeper. So we're deepening our ability to see into reality, and not necessarily with our eyes. A different kind of perception. Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva clearly saw emptiness of all the five conditions, thus completely relieving misfortune and pain. So Avalokiteshvara was vividly perceiving, clearly saw, vivid perception, emptiness. And what is she perceiving with? A couple days ago, or yesterday, I don't know when, Gokhan offered encouraging words to use our mind to see our mind. And Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, we can be sure, was vividly perceiving here and now. She couldn't be looking anywhere else. It can't be any other way. Because it's not an idea and it's not a philosophy. It's a direct experience. And direct experience happens here and now. Otherwise, it's a theory. And of course, Avalokiteshvara saw that ultimately there is no perceiver and there's nothing to perceive. That's the most vivid perception of all. I was thinking that vivid perception of the here and now, like, could be think non-thinking, what Dogen says. But, you know, even before we get to a place where we're kind of more developed in our Zazen, Zazen is still, like, even at the very beginning, helping to, like, cleanse and renew and lay fresh our perceptions, our ordinary perceptions. Like how the world sometimes sparkles in Sesshin, or like how, like, something you've never seen before is, like, amazing. I remember years ago cleaning out the sink on a meal crew in Sesshin, and all of the, you know, it was like the main dish sink, and all of the, like, beans and pieces of, like, cilantro and shards of onion that were left in the serving bowls had, like, gotten caught in the catch. And I was cleaning it out, and all of a sudden they were like jewels. So we can appreciate that. And on the wilderness trip, Hojin Sensei encouraged us to take up a practice of noticing. And we each had an illuminated journal that we were creating. And she would say, you know, just notice what you see. And so people were doing different kinds of things to explore that noticing. No-look drawings, watercolors, poems. You know, and the encouragement is, like, don't go for special conditions. So, like, don't, like, paddle out into the middle of the lake where you're going to have, like, the perfect view framed by everything. Just, like, plop yourself down and look. And I was looking through my notebook, and I found I had plopped myself down, and there was, like, where the waters of the lake had receded slightly, there was, like, a little pile of, like, pine needles and things like that, you know, that had, like, washed up in the lake. And I have these, like, wonderful little ink sketches, and each thing is labeled, and one says, this is like hair, beastie hair. And then there's another, like, little planty piney bits. And then another one, dried up leaf shells. And then I saw, wow, I think I just saw a bee pee. And I did. I was sitting there and I looked up and there was a bumblebee, and before I could like know what had happened, it went, and I was like, oh my God, did that just pee? A bumblebee pee. Annie Dillard has a wonderful phrase that she uses. She says, open up the present of the present. Like, this moment is your gift. Open it. Open it. And, you know, the noticing is like our human capacity to see and appreciate. In Annie Dillard's book, The Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, which is, I think maybe one of the, I read it in high school, and I think it was a turning text for me. Everybody else in my class thought it was so boring, and I was so into it, and my English teacher really loved me for that. Me and Mr. Ani, we were like this, because I got it. He was like, everyone's like, I don't know, she just talks about bugs all the time. And I was riveted. It's her, she spends a year in a little cabin just observing Tinker Creek. And it's her incredibly beautiful, thoughtful observations and ponderings. And she has a chapter in A Pilgrim at Tinker Creek called Intricacy, in which she talks about how, like, the world is, like, so detailed and so filled with, like, all of these really intricate, like, wonders that have apparently no actual function. I'm trying to decide which part to share. So she has this one part where she's talking about, she says, okay, just to give an example, like, pretend that you're God and you decide that you want to make a forest. Basically, you want to make something that's going to hold the soil and lock up solar energy and give off oxygen. So why not just like rough out a slab of chemicals? Like, why create a forest? Like, think of a forest. I've been noticing as we're in the fullness of summer, like all of the like shapes of leaves and like how many green things there are. So she says, okay, so imagine you're a retired railroad worker who makes replicas as a hobby. And you decide to make a replica of one tree, the longleaf pine your great-grandfather planted. Just a replica, it doesn't have to work. How are you gonna do it? How long do you think you might live, and how good is your glue? For one thing, you're gonna have to dig a hole and stick your replica trunk in the ground halfway to China if you want the thing to stand up, because you will have to work fairly big. If your replica is too small, you'll be unable to handle the slender three-sided needles, affix them in clusters of three in fascicles, and attach those Latin fascicles to flexible twigs. The twigs themselves must be covered by many silvery white fringed, long-spreading scales. Are your pine cones' scales thin, flat, rounded at the apex, the exposed portion, closed cone, reddish brown, often wrinkled, armed on the back with a small reflexed prickle which curves toward the base of the scale? When you loose the lashed copper wire, trussing the replica limbs to the trunk, the whole tree collapses like an umbrella. She talks about how the elm tree has 6 million leaves on one big elm, and they are toothed, and the teeth themselves are toothed. How many notches and barbs is that to a world? In and out go the intricate leaf edges, and nobody knows why. All the theories botanists have devised to explain the function of various leaf shapes tumble under an avalanche of inconsistencies. They simply don't know. Can't imagine. So this world, are we noticing? When our mind quiets, we can catch a glimpse. And then the implications of a glimpse give us some sense of like what's possible. They reverberate. You know, I think the implications of a glimpse are what keeps a lot of us coming back. Because you know it. And you imagine, okay, if that's true in that moment, like what is going on? I want to see. So this vivid perception asks us to give our whole attention to whatever is before us, to be steady, unshakable, unflinching. As Rakasan said the other night, come closer, closer. And our perception is so subtle. We can notice our own subtleties. Like, what's a mood? If you were talking to a species of creature that had no feelings, like a Vulcan, like, how would you describe, like, what's a mood? You know, you're like, yeah, well, when you're in a bad mood, everything that you normally love, like, you don't love it anymore. Like, what? So there's a coolness, a little bit of a coolness we can learn in Zazen, where we can start to see ourselves without being so invested in what we're seeing. And we can start to see ourselves and hopefully really bring forward gentleness and loving kindness. Pema Chodron talks about meditation as making friends with yourself. On the first day of Sishin, I was feeling cranky. You know, like tired and like distracted and really like after that Dawn Zazen, I just like wanted to go take a nap and I didn't take myself too seriously. I went and had my nap and then I was like, you know, I knew I didn't really want to stay in that state of mind. And I was thinking like, how do I sort of befriend this like grouchy part of myself that I wish would go away? And you know who came to mind? Oscar the Grouch. Oscar the Grouch. What a brilliant creation for like a being who's like super cranky and like still lovable. You know? Like you bang on or knock on Oscar's can and what does he say? Go away! He like pops his little head up and he's got the can on top and he's like, what do you want, you know? And he's his brown eyebrows and his furry green. And so I was thinking about Oscar and I was thinking about actually when I was a little girl, I have a bond with Oscar. When I was a little girl, my family was visiting the States. I lived for the early first 6 years of my life in Nairobi, in Kenya. And a few times we would come back to see family. And this visit that I remember, I must have been around five, I'm guessing. I remember we were staying at, you know, somebody's apartment, and I was getting to watch American television. And I don't remember like how I brokered this deal, but there was a deal that I was going to get to go to Macy's or Gimbel's, one of the big department stores. This is like 1977, 78, and pick out a toy. And there was a commercial that kept coming on, the way commercials do, for Baby This and That. And Baby This and That was this little baby doll that, like, they had a little jingle, and it showed like these little girls playing with her, and she had a toothbrush, and she had a telephone, and she had a straw. And a crayon. And you could put the things in her hand, and then like you'd squeeze her toes and her little arm would move. So it would look like she was like on the phone, or she was like drawing with her crayon or whatever. And the commercial made it look so great. I was like totally like, I wanted Baby This and That. And it would come on, I'd be like, Mom, it's on. I want Baby This and That. And my mother was not having it at all. And she was like, it's not gonna be like that. She was a total killjoy. I was like, what do you mean? She's like, it's not gonna be that great. It showed like her little mouth moving, singing along with the jingle. I don't think she actually did that, but it made her seem so lifelike and so pleasurable. And I was undeterred by my mother's skepticism, and I was like, no, I want Baby This and That. So we were going to go to the store, and my mom kept planting seeds. She was like, you know, if it doesn't turn out to be as great as you think, you can get something else, blah, blah, blah. And so we got there, and we went, and immediately it was so disappointing. She looked like hard and plastic. She wasn't like glittering at all, like in her little box with the cellophane front. And there was a part that said like, you know, touch me. And there was like a little hole where you could like stick your finger in to touch. And I thought she would be so deliciously like soft. And she wasn't. She was kind of like hard and plasticky. And immediately I was like, you could see kind of the seams in her. And yeah, my mom met me right there. She's like, okay, we don't have to get her. You can change your mind. I was like, you know, I don't want her. And so we marched over to the Sesame Street aisle, where the full array of Sesame Street Muppets was on display. And who did I go for? I guess I was acting out my rage at capitalism and the lies. I went right for Oscar. My mom was like, don't you want Grover or Cookie Monster? You know, someone kind of soft and cuddly. I was like, no, Oscar. And I took him home. He was big and furry and green. And I put him in the waste paper basket and started stomping on him. My parents were like, and I was like, he likes it. He likes it when I do that. So befriending our inner grouch. You know, a vivid perception means a vivid response. That's also the point, lest we forget, is not just to see clearly, but then to be able to act and manifest clearly. And I would say, you know, with love. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva is often depicted holding like a vase of like nectar, the nectar of compassion. That's like love juice. I thought it would be cool. You know, we do a lot, actually. We don't call it love, and it's probably good because love conjures up kind of sentimental ideas and notions. But actually, we do a lot that's arising from that ground of intimacy and taking care. I thought, like, what if we called caretaking practice, like, love-making practice? Couldn't you just see Genjo, like, giving some instructions? So really, you know, please, like, really love the weeds. really love the towels and the rags that you're working with, really love each other. And we do that service right before caretaking to Kanzeon, Kanon Bodhisattva. It's not coincidence. Love in action. So we might start very simply with the weeds and the towel and the rag and the people at Sishin, but of course the encouragement again and again in the teachings is to bring that great radiant heart of love into the world and let it touch all beings, including the difficult ones. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Love is the healing balm. In an essay on nonviolent resistance, Dr. King spoke about agape. And the essay is called An Experiment in Love. And he says, agape means understanding, redeeming goodwill for all people. It is an overflowing love which is purely spontaneous, unmotivated, groundless, and creative. It is not set in motion by any quality or function of its object. It is the love of God operating in the human heart. Later, as he's in the same essay, he's talking about the characteristics of nonviolent resistance. And he says, a sixth basic fact about nonviolent resistance is that it is based on the conviction that the universe is on the side of justice. Consequently, the believer in nonviolence has deep faith in the future. This faith is another reason why the nonviolent resistor can accept suffering without retaliation. For they know that in their struggle for justice, they have cosmic companionship. It is true that there are devout believers in nonviolence who find it difficult to believe in a personal God. But even these persons believe in the existence of some creative force that works for universal wholeness. So whether we call it an unconscious process, an impersonal Brahman, or a personal being of matchless power and infinite love, there is a creative force in this universe that works to bring the disconnected aspects of reality into a harmonious whole. Cosmic companionship. That's right. So we ended, we did the last few songs of our journey kind of en route home, and it worked out so beautifully because we were now at the end of Shakbar's whole work where he's talking about kind of coming into the world. And we had we were having brunch at this place that we go to in Long Lake where there's a picnic table is kind of under a sheltered porch. And it was, you know, we were down to like song 22 or something like that. And so we gathered in close. And so as not to, I don't know, freak people out in Long Lake, to do one of the last songs. And that song really struck me. It goes through five different Buddha manifestations, and each one is brought in. like, Vairocana is not outside. She exists within. She is the reality continuum, the nature of mind free of movement, the true nature of sloth pure as it stands. That is the real Bhagavan, Vairocana. And so I was thinking, you know, of the Kanzeon Bodhisattva. Kanzeon is not outside. They exist within. They are the great heart of compassion, the one who hears and responds, the true nature of grasping, pure as it stands. That is the real Kanzeon Bodhisattva. She's not outside. She exists within. He's not outside. He exists within. You are the true nature of Kanzeon Bodhisattva.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.